Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, cis and trans, humans and aliens, welcome back to the Integral Stages Author Series. I'm Layman Pascal, and I don't get paid for this, but it does count as part of my court-mandated community service. Today, I anticipate a very fun and rich philosophical conversation with process theologian Andrew Davis, who, although he didn't quite make it to the Metamodern Spirituality Retreat, has a new book on the metaphysics of exolife. Glad to have him here, because while I'm certainly capable of making statements like, Whitehead's God is the epitome of, rather than exception to, an extended naturalism of cosmic scope, that doesn't mean I know what I'm talking about. I'm just a simple redneck dandy, and I'd rather have someone else answer my ultra-arcane philosophical questions so I can stop trying to answer them myself and go back to my true passions, which are meditation, sex, and digging holes in the backyard. So I'm thrilled to have him here again. Hi, Andrew. Good to see you.
Layman, thanks for having me. You know, your intros have a way of abducting your listeners. Excellent.
That's right. This glad is Close to be Encounters back. Of the Ninth Kind. All right. Let's talk a little bit about the framing of this text. Seems like the jumping off point is your simultaneous appreciation of and critique of Stephen K. Dick's work on a naturalistic cosmotheology. You're looking at where Dick's reasoning opens up useful pathways to think a theology that's truly cosmic in scale, embraces the natural sciences, and holds space for superintelligence and the high likelihood of other theologically concerned species in the universe, but that nonetheless, from a Whiteheadian point of view, there are some insufficiencies in Dick's work around both the role of real religion in people's lives and the metaphysics necessary for a coherent notion of God. So it seems like you're saying that Dick is great. We love Dick. We should all probably be taking more Dick more deeply, but that in a few very particular areas, Dick is not always enough. Have I got that right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. So, I mean, the book really does. So Metaphysics of Exolife, for those viewers who haven't heard of it yet, which in its narrow focus is a constructive philosophical critique of Stephen J. Dick's work. Now, for those who haven't heard of Stephen Dick, he's a former NASA chief historian, a wonderful guy. And in the early 90s, he had held the Bloomberg chair in astrobiology at the Library of Congress. So for his whole career, he's been writing on the history of the plurality of worlds and extraterrestrial life and how these notions and ideas have been received in culture, in religion, in theology. And so his latter work about 20 years ago began thinking through how it is that theology and religion might need to change in light of the impact of discovery. And so what he calls his naturalistic cosmotheology is essentially his proposal for how it is we should rethink theology in light of cosmic evolution. So that if that's the narrow scope of the book, the broader scope is to say that from a wider lens, process philosophy and theology, which has been neglected largely in this discussion, has actually said quite a bit on this topic. And so in addition to majority of the book being a critique of Dick, the latter part, the appendices, are a documentation, essentially a historical witness of the relevance of process philosophy to this discussion. I document there some statements that a number of process theologians have made. So, of course, this discussion is ancient. It goes back all the way to the Atomists, the ancient Greece, but it's timely now as well for a number of reasons we might get into, not just the whistleblowers and UFO or UAF phenomena, which is quite interesting. I don't go into that in depth in this book, but it has a certain acuteness now, not just because of that, because I think we're learning more about the blurry lines between physics and cosmology. We're learning about how we fit in the universe and what happens here on this planet. There's no restriction on possibility such that something similar could not happen on other planets. But that gets us into the philosophy of it all. So I start there just because there's a narrow and a broader focus and then a contemporary focus as well that I think is timely with respect to the book. A lot of literature coming out, especially in the last couple of years on this topic and the role of philosophy and theology in particular. So I think it's one of many books that are going to be written about this. My effort is to try to inject the relevance and the reach of Whitehead and process thought into this conversation. So I hope I'm succeeding at that slowly.
Yeah, I think there's two frames in which this is timely. One is the more recent pivot in the cultural conversation around extraterrestrials and or whatever that points to. And the other one is just sort of the general late modern desire to make a concept of God that works with the natural sciences. And it seems like there's a couple of different ways to do that. One is to say that simply given enough time, the novelty and complexity of the cosmos could produce a super powerful super intelligence that might be worthy of worship. Another is sort of the idea that the universe itself is an information system that exhibits signs of a progressive migration to a condition in which it becomes an omnipowerful self-aware agent, a cosmos awakening over time to become a god. If we look at options like that through a white Whiteheadian lens, why are they metaphysically insufficient if they are?
Okay, good. Yeah, that's a great question. So you're pointing to part of the discussion I get in with respect to Stephen Dick's work about a naturalistic superintelligence. So he leverages the idea essentially that why can't we essentially think of God, quote unquote, maybe a little g, as he suggests, although he doesn't quite like the term God and suggests that theology is just about meaning making. So we might critique that. But he suggests that why not use the term God for a highly evolved superintelligence that may retain the kind of attributes that have traditionally been assigned to God. So omnipotence, omniscience, etc. So I think on Whitehead's scheme, and I document some statements he makes, at least as reported by his biographer, and there's debate about whether he would truly make those statements. I think there's nothing, just as a statement, there's nothing in those statements that I find incoherent with respect to his philosophy. He makes statements that suggest that there can be very highly evolved intelligences above us, right? He even suggests that there could be a sentient nebula. Now that's an interesting idea, but in principle, his categories of being and becoming, of value, of intelligence, of organism, there's no cap on those with respect to achievement. And so there could certainly be intelligences far higher and far above us, and it's a metaphysical question as to what we share with those intelligences, but should we use the language of God for that intelligence? And that's why I push back a bit. So, for example, just to use Dick as an example, he suggests that a highly evolved superintelligence could have fine-tuned, the constants of nature, strong and weak force, gravity, electromagnetism. What I challenge in that is it seems that he at once wants to hold on to the fact this is a fully contingent product of cosmological evolution that came into being, but that it also fine-tuned these things. So it seems to be contradictory to say that those two can stay together because its existence, its emergence would itself be a product of that tuning, which is prior to it, right? Of course, the fine-tuning is a larger discussion, but so my critique of certain evolved, highly superintelligent proposals is that they do lack one attribute that has always been essential to the tradition of philosophical theology, and that's been necessary existence, right? So Dick and others, Nick Bostrom, have proposed sort of emerging contingent superintelligences, but our questions of metaphysics push even past them. What is the grounds, the conditions of the existence of those superintelligent pseudo-divine beings? So I don't think it's reached the level of theology just yet, but of course that's an ongoing debate, and I'm looking forward to other responses, Dick's included, with respect to how I push back a bit.
I was thinking about Einstein's famous use of the relative invariance of the square of the speed of light to bring different measurement contexts together and translate between them. People think of him as introducing relativity, but really he was trying to solve the problem of relativity, bringing radically different perspectives together in a way where they can talk to each other meaningfully. And I'm wondering if you think of a process theological concept of God as a kind of apex entity or apex concept or apex meaning that could act as a leverage point of mutual navigation and mutual translation between highly disparate species evolved under very different conditions. Would highly different intelligences from different worlds be able to recognize sort of an ultimate concept in like a Whiteheadian metaphysical process notion of God? Could that be something they would have to have in common that could be the basis for their mutual coordination of meaning?
Yeah, that's a really great question. I'd say in principle, no. It's not as if they would have to come to the same conclusions about ultimacy. It's almost certain that they wouldn't, in some sense. In fact, Lewis Ford, the great process philosopher and theologian, he wrote in 1968 what I found to be the earliest sustained consideration of this topic in light of process thinking. It's called Theological Reflections in Extraterrestrial Life. And that's in the second appendix to the book, but he raises that question saying perhaps a highly evolved species has evolved past the need for God, right? In some sense. Of course, he doesn't go into how that notion is understood. So I want to say no initially. I want to allow for absolute diversity when it comes to thinking about ultimacy and metaphysics and the metaphysical foundations, divine foundations, however that's conceived. And yet, I want to say that there are some conclusions that terrestrial beings can come to that would be shared in common. In the first place, I think our emergence on a Whiteheadian scheme would share certain metaphysical antecedents that, at least in principle, can be applied universally. And the question is, how best do we make sense of those in the nature of things? How best do we make sense of a fluid evolutionary world that is achieving life-minded value potentially universally? And to the extent that we think we need to explain that with a more inclusive framework that is divine, I think we might be able to come to similar kinds of understandings, whether it's mind, whether it's value. We sort of talked about that last time a little bit. So I feel ambivalent about saying, we're going to come to the exact same understanding. It doesn't have to be a Whiteheadian understanding, of course, unless there's an extraterrestrial Whiteheadian thinker out there in some way. To what extent can we actually pierce what's actually going on? Our metaphysics is always tentative, our theories are always tentative. But I think there's some domains of nature, of cosmology, of metaphysics that we do share and would share with extraterrestrial others. Should we ever have contact with them, or if we have already, maybe that would be an interesting topic to explore further. So does that begin to shed light a little bit on where you're
It
getting at?
begins, and I guess my curiosity is around the idea that, like, obviously they would evolve very different ideas of God or not of God, but this depends on how we're thinking about God. If we're thinking about God and could call it something else, and what we really mean is a particular nexus of meaning structures that we find that we need in order to make coherence out of the universe, then is it likely that we and they would need to have found something similar in order to communicate across our otherwise contingent and evolved differences? And then the second part of that would be, would there be any way for us to tell in advance, right? If we were just looking at all the human concepts of God, would we be able to say, oh, that one, if we needed it, could probably span between species, but these ones wouldn't be able
Right.
to?
Yeah, no, it is a challenge. I don't think there is any ultimate shared concept of God that might map from planet to planet. Again, I think, but we might approach that if we begin to, in some sense, identify the antecedent conditions which brought us into being, and then problematize those conditions in some way. Why is it, for example, that the universe harbors not simply pervasive life, if it does, but the possibilities of pervasive life? You'll remember that I'm sort of haunted by these infinite possibilities. I think Whitehead was as well. So what, assuming those possibilities need explanation, and that's a big assumption, as I continue to debate with people, what framework do you make sense of that? We see in evolution not simply the fact that possibilities are actualized, but that higher life and value and experience is attained. What accounts for an upward trend in that process? Assuming intelligent species ask these questions, and it seems like it belongs to intelligence to probe and to seek in some way, then perhaps we would near more of a common understanding of the divine with respect to that which contains the possible, that which grounds value. And that's what stimulates a process beyond mere existence to an aesthetic quality of existence. And when we look at the evolutionary process, at least for Whitehead, that's what we see, not simply the drive to live, but he says to live well and to live better. It's this qualitative ascent towards higher life value and meaning. But of course, this is theorizing. This is theorizing. But I do think metaphysics is a worthwhile endeavor. I think to the extent that philosophers exist on other planets, and I essentially wrote this book for them, I think that they'll come to some manner of similar conclusion.
It seems like a lot of people have this urge to want to see if they can talk about God in a way that brackets or removes the supernatural. How do we get a naturalistic God? Now, we could problematize our desire to do that in a number of different ways. But when you look at, say, the naturalistic cosmos that Dick is thinking through in order to come up with his arguably theological concepts, what is it leaving out? What's limiting about that notion of the natural? What do we need to have in an extended naturalism that he's not including?
Yeah, great question. These terms naturalism and supernatural are thrown around quite a bit, and often vacuously, because we're not exactly told what they refer to, what they mean. So my initial critique for Dick is he hasn't told us what is ultimately natural in his scheme. He wants to preserve, for example, an ethical sense. He wants to preserve an experiential sense in the universe, and wants to rid any notion that there's entities or gods or a place of heaven beyond the universe. But there's no necessity, I'd say, to understand those in purely natural ways. One could arguably make the case that God is the most natural reality there is. So I think his naturalism, it tends to assume non-theism and atheism when those are not equivalent, right? Especially in the process tradition, I think of David Ray Griffin, who argued that, atheism presupposes naturalism. Naturalism in no way presupposes atheism. So process thought pushes towards a naturalistic understanding of divinity, and would argue that this relationship between God and the world is far from supernatural. There's no exteriority involved. There's no intervention from the outside. Where would the outside be? So I push Dick to take more seriously a naturalistic theism, which incorporates and I think resolves some issues that resolve or that still remain on his system. Questions of value, questions of possibility. For example, he says human beings are not morally central. Certainly not. We're not biologically central either. But neither is any other species on any other planet. So assuming we do come into contact, on what grounds do we say we shouldn't eradicate each other in a dark forest, as Xun Li pronounced the answer to the Fermi paradox? So I think it pushes back to the question is, what is the ground of ethical and moral obligation? What is the ground of the possible and the ground of value in this universe? And none of that seems to me to imply supernaturalism. These are principal metaphysical questions that we can't just immediately push something to be supernatural if we are uncomfortable with it. So I sense that in him a little bit. But of course he's a historian and he's not a philosopher. So I want to be gracious in my response to him. He's actually a wonderful guy. We've developed a nice friendship. So
If we want to be able to say that our definition of the natural includes most of the phenomenon described as supernatural, why not call it supernatural? Is it just a historically contingent phobia around that term? Or why would we want to excise the supernatural from our model? What's the motivation?
Well, I think it is a phobia, that term. I think in the scientific community, if you bring that term around, you get, people's skin crawling, right? So in part, the rejection of the notion of supernatural action or supernaturalism is a outgrowth of religion and science discussions, right? And it's I think an anxiety of theologians and religious advocates who are wanting to speak about some manner of coherence between theology and science, but do it in a way that is acceptable to the broader scientific community. So I think terms are problematic. Terms matter. This is why, in part, Dick rejects, or at least doesn't find the need to use the language of God, because it is a loaded term. I'd say the same for supernaturalism. But of course, the details always matter. Devil's in the details. So we may find things in the universe we claim to be supernatural, and it all matters how we develop what that means. We're not speaking of a divinity that's outside the world and injecting himself or herself or itself into the world in a kind of coercive fashion. We're talking about it welling up from within. It's a divine action, at least for Whiteheadian thinkers, is part and parcel of the normal natural processes of the world. So I fully agree. These are problematic terms, and maybe not supernatural, but supra natural, right? As some have wanted to make the distinction, but I'm not too happy with that either. So it's a problem. It remains an ongoing problem.
Theologians seem to straddle a territory that's between priest and philosopher. And in the philosophical context, we can look at the universe and go, what is it made of? What's legitimate about the way we might phrase this or that interpretive context? But on the priest side, religion has to do something for people. It has to do something for culture. And it seems to me that loaded terms that might be anathema to certain kinds of philosophical thinking might be absolutely necessary in order for the function of religion to take place in the world. Mm-hmm. What do you think? What's insufficient about Dick's theology or other theologies of that kind in terms of their ability to serve an actual religious function rather than just to serve a descriptive function that makes them feel okay in the philosophical domain?
Yeah, great question. I think what's essential when it comes to the practical function of religion is seeing that in the nature of things, there is something of supreme and unsurpassable wisdom that in principle you can be in touch with, and that in principle can guide a certain function, right? So we might say that religion is at base level a desire to be in harmony with the nature of things as you conceive them. So I think for most religious people, if they were to approach Dick's scheme, you know, Dick, he's a Unitarian, you know, and again, I think wavers on this discussion because I'm not sure he realized what sort of options were available philosophically with respect to naturalism, et cetera. But I think that ultimately it does mean something whether or not God, very slender said, has been completely ontologically negated, or whether there is a reality that is present in this world and all worlds that can guide our functioning, that can give us senses of peace, that can be the ground for some mode of religious experience and sort of wisdom. So, I mean, it's a tough question because I'm not sure how, if he's implemented his naturalistic cosmotheology in religious contexts. But what I would push to, being both the philosopher and sort of less so the priest, although I like mentorship, I like getting into personal religious dimensions with respect to these questions, I think that it's important religiously to say that that you're not an exception in the nature of things, that there's something that you reflect that's actually there, that hasn't just evolved into being, although it does that too, but is there as a permanent essence of the universe. I think that that is Whitehead's claim. So, but that doesn't perhaps satisfy your question, and I don't know if it would satisfy most religious people, but of course I'm speaking out of my own religious experience and religious belonging as well in some sense. So what do you think about that?
Yeah, I think that's perfectly reasonable. And like you say, we really wouldn't know unless there was an attempt to interpersonally instantiate Dick's theological vision.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, from it's interesting the way people weight those things differently. Some people are more concerned about having a coherent model, and whether or not it actually changed people's lives is important, but not that important. And other people have the exact opposite balance. I lean a little bit more that way. I think there's a lot of room for religion and the concept of God to serve a function, and there's some wiggle room. It doesn't have to be objectively accurate. You could have those as two relatively independent domains, but if you have a notion of God that doesn't do the thing for people that the notion of God is supposed to do, then why bother calling it God?
Indeed. Well, and you may know that Whitehead too talks about the secular function of God being just as important, essentially, as the religious function of God. So, and that's a sort of interesting discussion. At least in his universe, the function of God is everywhere and always active, even if it's not consciously acknowledged or realized. But I think you're pushing towards this the function needs to have a conscious impact for us in order to do real work. But I think he would push back and say there's a secular function that in principle needs no acknowledgement and doesn't even need to rise to consciousness, but it's still the current below our processual feet, if you want. But am I right? You're wanting to say that it needs to rise to a level of impact consciously in our lives practically?
Yeah, I think it has to have a meaning producing cultural instantiation and an ability to transform individual lives.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you know, we can say it has a general function as a part of reality.
Yeah.
But if it doesn't actually do the thing that people were hoping religion was going to do for them anciently, then it sort of falls outside of that discourse.
Yeah, no, I think that's important. I think one distinction we should make is, you know, I've been speaking here mainly philosophically, And I would like take it as the god of philosophers, for example, which arguably is not the god of religion. At least some people like to say that. But there has to be relevance between them in some sense. I think culturally embedding these concepts within the development of a religious culture is where that impact happens. So, for example, there's Christian astrotheology, Christian cosmotheology. There's Jewish or Islamic cosmo or astrotheology. So I think where the change happens is within the historical embedment, if you want, of these concepts in the experience of individuals. So I certainly agree it needs work, but philosophically, if we stay in the philosophical domain by itself, I'm not sure that practical work that you want will be done. It's provided me with quite a bit of comfort and existential benefit, but I realize that for many people, this needs to be located more contextually in a cultural I system, in a religious system itself. So that's quite important, I think. And we can imagine that there are cultures and religions of certain kinds that populate the universe. Again, Lewis Ford references this and even speculates about, comparative extraterrestrial religion. But this element of evolved culture and evolved religion, these are intimately wedded, and I don't think we can lose sight of them ultimately, even when I want to, again, be finagling in the philosophical background in some sense. So I agree in part, but it's hard to parse out, I think.
Yeah, it is. You make some mention in this book about the possibilities of Islamic cosmotheology, and you just mentioned Jewish, Christian, Islamic. There's all kinds of different astrotheology. I've been very interested in
Yeah.
indigenous futurism lately. Do you see patterns of difference between, say, Islamic, Jewish, and Christian cosmotheological attempts?
Yeah, that's from the literature I've read, and I think with respect to the Islamic discussion, this is still pretty new. There's, I think, a couple texts out that I reference, and a lot of them, with respect to the Jewish conversation as well, a lot of them are pointing back to textual material first, scriptural material, right? So they're trying to, in some sense, give scriptural support to our imaginative capacities with respect to life and intelligence, right? Well, why on earth would God be restricted in such a way to produce only one world? Some have argued that, right? Aristotle thought there was one world for philosophical reasons. So I think the patterns initially are wanting to embed this kind of type of questioning in the scriptural canons and say that there's a place for it, and then leverage from that philosophically outward. That's the sort of patterns I've seen. And certainly Ted Peters and other astro theologians have done that as well. But it doesn't just stay there. There's philosophical argument involved. But I think my comparative astrotheology on this planet, at least, is something I'm still getting into. So I would like to do much more investigation. I plan to within this interreligious astrotheological landscape. It's quite interesting. I will say, reserving my comments to the West, right? If we jump to the East, Hindu cosmology, Jain cosmology, Buddhist cosmology, for since their inception, really have had vast multiplicities of life and cosmoi, if you want, that have always been a part of that cosmic setting. So in the conference we had a few years ago, where Dick was there and Ted Peters and others, there were several presentations given on Hindu cosmology and how this is really not a new idea for that kind of cosmology. Of course, there's elements we could parse out, but I think that distinction is important as well. It helps also to see that Jewish philosophers and theologians, Islamic philosophers and theologians, certainly Christian philosophers and theologians have raised these questions before. So that you can draw a certain trend within a strand within these traditions all the way to the current day and say that there's a current of this style of thinking. And now, given all that we know, we can begin to develop that much further. I think that's what's happening across these different traditions.
How legitimate do you think it is to read, say, the Vedas or the Old Testament as containing recordings of experiences that we would today perhaps describe as UFO phenomena?
Okay. Your question was how legitimate
Yeah, because
okay.
there's other ways to interpret those scriptures.
Certainly. Certainly. Yeah. Frankly, I think that's a very large step, I think it's a very large step to project this phenomena backwards and then say that's sort of the way of explaining some of these events, which could be explained in innumerable other ways. not least metaphor, you know. But at the same time, I want to be open to the fact that there's no principle, there's no in principle reason to say that there hasn't been supremely advanced beings that potentially could be interacting with the cosmos, with various planets. But I would not want to make the step that I can then make the case that UFOs are what, you know, helped Moses or, you know, these built the pyramids. I mean, there's interesting stuff on that. I think there's a lot of data with respect to the UFO phenomenon. There's a lot of bad data, but there's a lot of it. So provided data is trustworthy, we can make these extensions. But I think the appeal of reaching back into scripture with respect to UFO phenomena is again to try to root this in a tradition. But I wouldn't make that step myself. Yeah.
Your book, it seems to me, circulates between several different senses of what we might mean by cosmocentric consciousness. So there's the sheer physical expanse of the cosmos. There are the issues of anomalous non-human intelligences. There's the artistic and mystical sense of wonderment beyond earthly limitations. There's the philosophical drive to have a coherent model of reality that's not just bound by terrestrial sense-making. Are these all facets of the same thing, or are we at risk of confusing our reasoning by conflating different styles of cosmocentric consciousness?
I mean, I think they'd have to relate in some sense, right? To have anything conscious and have different modes of consciousness assumes connections between those domains of consciousness in some sense. So I don't immediately know the answer to that question, of course. But the fact that we have conscious beings on this universe is quite extraordinary. So, as I argue, it raises a larger question about the antecedent metaphysical conditions of consciousness. And not just that, of biology, of life, of value. All of which, if I'm going to argue through Whitehead, go all the way down in the nature of things. Now, it makes some people nervous, but I was just reading Modes of Thought. I don't know if you've read that book, but he's highly recommended. I think it's one of the best books to start with when it comes to Whitehead. But he does make the case that the functions of life are essentially self-enjoyment, creative activity, and aim, right? This ability to navigate the possible on the behalf of producing something actual. And so this element of experience, not yet conscious, is all the way down. Life, arguably, is all the way down. It's a living ontology, and it reacts to a dead, mechanistic, materialistic ontology. Experience evolves and blooms late in the evolutionary process into consciousness, and from there, all different modes of conscious states and capacities emerge. So I think, certainly, there's different states of consciousness, as you mentioned, but they have a experiential root all the way down in ontology. And that's quite helpful because we're baffled at the notion that if the universe is fundamentally dead in its essence, why on earth there should be living, experiencing, valuing beings like ourselves. So our existence, even if we reserve it to this planet, assumes certain metaphysical antecedents that I think we need to probe. And I think Whitehead helps us do that, and then sees a continuum in emergence on a scale that leads us up to higher and higher states of achievement, value, mind, consciousness, and far beyond us as well, to potentially God, who is not an exception to these domains, right? But in some sense, supremely embodies, contextualizes, and culminates them, right? Again, that's a much larger philosophical debate. So what do you think about that? I mean, I wouldn't want to draw arbitrary distinctions between these kinds of abilities, yeah, with respect to consciousness. They all come together.
I mean, my sense of the way reality looks is that a lot of these things are intrinsic, but there might be some growing together of disparate things or some degree of artifice in the things that were grouped together under the notion of the cosmocentric. It's not clear to me whether it is or isn't the case that the contemporary notion of the universe is fundamentally connected to the ancient sense of what we would now call cosmic wonder, but might have called something completely different a few thousand years ago. There's a number of different things, and I just don't know how connected they are or aren't, but I'm seeing them grouped together a lot lately.
Yeah, yeah. No, certainly, certainly. It is unique that the universe produced wandering beings like us. I would like to say that that suggests something about its nature and character. So again, I wouldn't want to make the claim that the universe is just anthropocentric or anthropomorphic. I think we should be very careful of that, and that's persistently in the literature, right? The Copernican decentering, right? Small planet, as Whitehead says, circling around a small sun. We barely emerged to differentiate ourselves from animal life. And yet our experience is a grand fact in the universe and is revelatory in some sense as to where to begin reflecting theologically. So I like to say, most recently in a chapter I've been working on, the universe is not anthropomorphic, human beings are cosmorphic, right? We take on the deeper shapes and rhythms of the cosmos. And beginning with our experiences is the only way to begin piercing the depths, if you want. Or you could say we're not, anthropocentric or anthropocosmic, right, in some way. So I'm playing sort of with these kinds of terms. And of course, the great traditions, the spiritual traditions, have always spoken in terms of human beings being a cosmic phenomenon. Teilhard, not least, most recently. But you go back, I mean, even the notion of Atman being Brahman, right? You can read that as a deep connection from our finite selves to the infinite self in some way. There's a connection there. So I think that's spiritually significant. It's philosophically significant. Knowing thyself, right? Here's another notion from the ancient Greek ideas, right? That we are cosmorphic in some sense, and that this provides our recentering with respect to this Copernican issue. We're certainly not the center. No one would claim that. We've been decentered cosmologically, and yet recentered metaphysically. I think that's what it allows us to do, and that's where I'm pushing back on Dick's sort of short-sighted reading of this Copernican decentering. Real as it is, Whitehead accepts it too, but it's not the whole story. It's a half truth. So.
It occurs to me that one of the ways to read kind of a biblical creation myth is to think of Eden as the biosphere and man as the emergence of a prominent sapient species within that biosphere who has a special experiential mode. Now, that might be something that's happening for the first time on this planet, or it might be that that's a frequent occurrence on planets throughout the cosmos and that there are many biospheres and each biosphere does something similar, is kind of a gardener that has something equivalent to man. What difference do you think it would make historically if our religious texts had embedded that kind of a plurality? If it had said one of the gardens of Eden, rather than the Garden of Eden, would that have had an impact on us through history?
Oh, I think so. Yeah, I think so. Just because, given the intricate ways in which we read our scriptures and the attention we pay to original translations and renderings and words, singular or plural, absolutely. I mean, here's a sort of example. My fiance's religious background is the Baha'i faith. Now, of course, Baha'i faith, for those who are unfamiliar, is a relatively new religious, orientation, incorporating much from the past, but quite new in some ways. It's, roughly less than 200 years old. Their texts, if you look at them, talk about infinite worlds. Their texts talk about sheer multiplicity, and then they justify it on theological grounds. If Christian faith or Jewish or Islamic scriptures, did something like that, I think we'd be in a much different place today. We recall, of course, poor Giordano Bruno in 1600, who at least in part was burnt at the stake for his suggestion that an infinite God would create nothing short of infinite worlds, right? But that was quite scary to the authorities that be. Not all Christian tradition was that hostile as the tradition developed, but I think that's quite interesting. Of course, the Baha'i faith emerges within scientific cosmology as well, and those insights. But absolutely, I think if there were statements as if in the Rig Veda, the Upanishads, if they appeared that clearly in the Hebrew scriptures, I think we'd have much more grounds to argue from scripture on these things. But yeah, that's an interesting question. And
You
we have a
were
canon.
mentioning, yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was just going to say the fact that our canon in principle is closed, right? The oral canon is not closed, the practical, but it's not as if we're adding to these scriptures. And that can be seen as a benefit or a big fault in some way, right? I can see both sides of that. And not all traditions have a closed canon, which seems to suggest that here it is, right? When in fact, a processual world is never finished, right? And revelation in principle is never finished, right? So Baha'i faith and Christian tradition talk about this progressive revelation. Continuous creation seems to assume logically progressive revelation. So, I mean, and that's an ongoing debate as well. So
it's interesting to me because it seems like there's two ways for a canon to be closed. One is externally closed to additional or future revelations. The other is sort of inwardly closed in terms of its interpretation of its own contents, right? Like the gospel is very peculiar in the sense that it presents four slightly different versions of the life of Christ as if we're peering into the multiverse. A lot of people have read some of the early terms for the Lord in the Old Testament as essentially being plural nouns of various kinds.
Mm-hmm.
So there are interpretive possibilities to open in the multiplicity. And it may be that we've had a social and emotional attitude that's allowed our monotheism to want to be singular, to want to be compressed and contracted and linear and distinct in that fashion, even if there were reasons that we might have gone the other way with it.
Yeah, I think that's really well put. And the implications of that, I think, are important, right? I like your multiverse comment in some sense with respect to the different accounts of Jesus in the Gospels. And of course, if extending that out doctrinally, one of the big debates in the current literature is whether there would be, to put it as one thinker did, a planet-hopping Jesus, right? This was his critique. How are we supposed to, you know, we will not say that the Lord is going to hop planets to, you know, or you know, multiple incarnations. This is a very important topic with respect to the current conversation, internal to Christian faith, obviously. Tehard raises the question, since we have a Tehard conference next at the end of this month, where I'm sort of leveraging these ideas with respect to Tehard, who said much more than Whitehead did, actually, and quite interesting. But he, you know, did other planets fall? Did they suffer from original sin? If so, that affects how we understand, you know, God's relation to them. So I think when you begin to see the diversity of Scripture and leverage that into doctrinal diversity, doctrinal understanding, mapped against the diversity of the cosmos and what we're learning from the book of nature, as the pioneer thinkers of modern science, themselves Christians, at least at the beginning, said, we can make those commentaries. So some have, you know, put forth the need to revise the Nicene Creed, right? Let's make it much more cosmic in scope, not just as a planetary with respect to Earth. But it's all fascinating, and it's about this is I think this discussion is pointing to the evolutions of our traditions in new ways, and it's another example of how science is informing theology. But for me, theology can and also does inform science at various levels, not least philosophically, metaphysically, as I put forth in the book. So at least ideally, I should see that relationship as having a kind of mutuality to it.
You mentioned a few minutes ago the sort of Whiteheadian notion that value is implicit to reality. And if we think of, you know, value as being something like that, something ontological and not just merely a superfluous human subjective activity, and then we assume that any other species would also have some deep relationship to value. And if they were a sophisticated species, they'd probably have, like we have, the ability to clarify and amplify value into things like beauty and truth and goodness and
turn
that
up
kind
the
of
volume.
Stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
But does that imply that there's a strong likelihood that we will be able to recognize value experience in each other? Or does value come in variations that are so great we would be unable to, in theory, recognize them? And if we couldn't recognize them, if there's a computational irreducibility between our different modes of value, does it matter that value is everywhere if you can't recognize it? If its internal diversity is so potentially great that you might not ever be able to acknowledge that from your perspective?
Yeah, that's a really wonderful axiological question. So I think I would certainly worry about value being value, but can never be recognized as such as value. Doesn't mean that, you know, it is purely subjective per se, but I'd want to say that there are domains of value that in principle are shared, and that could, at least in principle, be recognized. So think about, for example, the concept of harmony, whether it's in the motion of the planets, the song, sound, human lives tuned as an instrument. I think these things can be recognized in a deep sense. And in principle, extraterrestrial music, art, and potentially morality is of the kind that it could be mutually recognized. Of course, I want to be careful in saying that too. So, even Whitehead pushes back, saying, assuming there is, or saying he pushes back the notion that there's regulative notions that are sufficiently precise, he says, to apply to every planet and every star system, every being. This is in Adventures of Ideas. And he rejects that notion, saying, there's no one perfection at which the universe aims, and all realization of the good is finite, contextual. But it's good nonetheless, right, in some sense. So I want to be careful. But I'll say this also is that value belongs to the very becoming of an event, at least on Whiteheadian metaphysics. And so the emergence, the higher emergence of intelligence being only sees value turned up experientially. Remember this qualitative increase that we're talking about. So in that qualitative increase births morality out of aesthetic experience, right? Some want to say that is a pure subjugation of morality to aesthetics, but I think it's actually just a statement as to a coherent evolutionary origin of morality, right? Because there's stages of the universe, electrons, protons, where morality or ethics doesn't make any sense. But aesthetic experience and aesthetic value does make sense at that level, right? So that's all to say that value is inherent in ontology for Whitehead. The expressions of this, vastly diverse it may be, I think can be recognized. There's some notions that are so fundamental, harmony, intensity, that we can see in human life and art and music that I think in principle could be recognized. And that's why SETI should be sending music across the universe in harmonious patterns, right? Mathematics has been
Which
used
music would you send?
like yeah, probably probably Metallica Black Album. No, I don't know. But it's interesting, right? So mathematics is a form of patterning and beauty as well. So assuming there are objective mathematical ideals and truths and patterns of truth, this might be a means of communicating. And not just radio signals that say, nothing. But so there it's a there's a could be an interesting axiological basis for contact. And why not make contact on the things that are most meaningful to us? And I would argue that those are the domains of value that give our lives meaning, aesthetic, moral, ethical value. I think they're just inescapable. And the more I think about it, the more I tend to just agree further and further with that. But what do you think? I mean, you seem to be axiologically inclined in a deep sense. I think in our last conversation, you said that this is an irreducible notion or domain of reality in some way. Could there be so diverse values that are unable to be recognized in principle? I mean, I'm not sure. I'm not sure if that's coherent, but I have to be open.
Yeah, my experiential and analytic examination of my own experience of reality makes it seem like value, at least in something like an aesthetic form, like in the ability to recognize coherence. And I think that functionality and efficacy are subsets of coherence in certain ways,
Sure.
that
Yeah.
that's necessary in order for anything intelligible to operate. However, I'm very attentive to arguments like those that come out of, say, Stephen Wolfram's computational models of the universe, which are suggesting that by and large, most of the possible patterns computationally couldn't be reduced by other computational patterns in a way that would make them intelligible. So that the majority of the patterning possibilities in reality would not stand out as patterns to people looking at it from a particular angle. So that there might be sense-making systems in other parts of the pattern verse that are able to compress certain patterns that we just never come across, or that there are aspects of reality that, although they're functional, could never be detected by us as being coherent, even if they are, and that we that may then require something like, I mean, that might be what mystery stands for. That might be the role of the unconscious or the magical in religious domains, is we have to have some plausible workability or ability to stand with what we absolutely can't recognize, even though everything we can recognize seems to be permeated by value. So
yeah.
I don't want to let go either of the fact that I find value to be omnipervasive, or of the fact that there might be a fundamental limitation on my ability to recognize and detect aspects of reality.
Yeah, and I like that quite a bit. I think of the element of our spiritual traditions that through discipline and through practice attune us to the recognition of value more deeply. In our modern world, we're very, running a rat race, and we miss all sorts of things all the time. Even the scientific endeavor, which Whitehead says can't even get started without the assumptions of value, itself awakens to deeper patternings of value, right? It's interesting to hear arguments for something being true because it's beautiful and vice versa, right? People push back at that too. But this element of aesthetics and truth and recognition, I think, are a deep part of spiritual practice, and not just quote unquote religious practice, but scientific practice as well. What I discerned in what you were saying there back a moment ago also was this notion, as Whitehead put it, that all order or patterning is aesthetic in nature. And that seems to me to be a fundamental conviction that I can't escape. Any mode of order whatsoever is a kind of aesthetic order. It assumes deeper aesthetic standards in the nature of things. So Whitehead says, for example, it doesn't happen to be the case that there's a world that accidentally exhibits a particular order. He says there is a world because there is a more fundamental order, and we have to question the nature of that order. Or Hartshorne too would say, the laws of harmony and intensity are more ultimate than the laws of nature and the reason for there being those laws, right? And these are aesthetic notions. The regulation of the planets, the emergence of form and habit in nature is already an aesthetic achievement. So none of that needs to be recognized overtly by us. But then when you take the level of harmony and put it into a human life or put it into music, these are the kinds of value that we can and should recognize, that we should implement, you know? So I think that's a fascinating discussion. And my discovery of what I say the primordiality of value has been so important for my thinking. And I think it's at the heart of Whitehead, and it should be at the heart of thinking about this extraterrestrial discussion. Last thing I'll say on that is I have a project coming out the next year or two, which assembles 20 or so contributions on exo-axiology. Is there value beyond Earth? And how should we think about whether or not subjective or objective renderings of value implicate our thinking about our relation to other worlds? So I guess stay tuned for that. So I hope to be getting that going in the next year, but it's super fascinating discussion.
I think it's, it's fun and it's empowering. And Whitehead gives us a really interesting set of tools for thinking the commonality of reality and the commonality of species in a much more powerful way than we often have in the past. But I think there's a concern about whether or not that adequately enfolds the incoherence, right? Like, if all patterns have an aesthetic, that doesn't preclude that some aesthetics are unbearable or unprocessable, right? That in addition to God, there's, the Lovecraftian monster of the cosmos, yeah. whose aesthetic would just be so foreign to us, so truly alien, that yeah. we wouldn't really be able to process or interact with it in any intelligible way.
Oh, I think that's a really important comment. And note that Whitehead, too, says that evil has an aesthetic dimension to it, right? Auschwitz, which I walked through in 2017, was an aesthetically intense event, but it was also evil. I'd be willing to make that claim, right? So just because something is aesthetically intense doesn't make it by definition good. Here we are again arguing about the relationship between the transcendentals, goodness and beauty, as expression in human life. So I wouldn't want to make the case that every aesthetic concoction or constellation is by its nature good. I want to be careful doing that. But I do think it's the context out of which good is birthed. If you want to see on an evolutionary level how morality arises, I think you have to start in some sense with this aesthetic experience all the way down. Right. Anyway, but no, that is an important comment.
Yeah, I don't think evil is, you can't conceptualize evil without implying an orientation away from it. Like even the pit of ultimate darkness suggests a relationship to something that's better than itself. So,
right.
Like good is implicit in the definition of evil to some extent. But here's what just came up for me is, So I put your book, translated your book into an audiobook, and I would listen to it, and I would go for a mocha at like walk 45 minutes and then walk back to get my drink. And so there's aspects of the book that are instantiated for me in certain places. There were things I would think when I came through the park, you know?
Nice.
And while I was in the park, the question that was often on my mind was something like this. It was, okay, so given that the cosmos is bound to advance into novelty, and supposing that you had enough time for a cognitive agent to evolve into some godlike status, would that being, could it figure out some way to be metastable by structuring itself to regenerate itself on novelty and difference, as if change was the fuel or the engine of maintaining itself? Or would a super being, no matter how well structured, eventually be undone and replaced by the eternal advance into novelty? Like, could it stabilize as a novelty engine, or would it eventually be undone?
I've actually thought of a kind of similar question like that, but I love the way you put that. Well, think about the evolutionary process for a second. This process, in order to give birth to beings like ourselves or higher beings, has to outsmart entropy in some way, right? Now, we're frail beings. We don't know how to regenerate ourselves and continually outsmart entropy so that we can avoid death and decay. But in principle, there is an arc in the universe that is counter-entropic, and Whitehead puts it that way, not just him, but others. It's a uphill climb against this downhill tug of entropy, and that's fascinating. So I am fully open to the notion that there could be epochs in which evolution reaches such a state that it can continually perpetuate itself. That's a fascinating idea, right? From finitude to infinitude, this sort of arc. How that would happen, I'm not quite sure, but you know, this is the context in which some have talked about God not yet, right? We're getting there, right? The emergence of this mind, some way that can infinitely perpetuate itself, and maybe many times over, right? So John Leslie, for example, at an axiological argument, argues for infinite divine minds. Now, they have necessity for him. These ones wouldn't have necessity. But in principle, even if there were contingently self-propagating minds, you still push back to the basis of their emergence, right? So I think it's possible, yes. And I need to think through that a bit further, but why shouldn't it be possible? Unless entropy does collapse all things, which it might, or there may be catastrophic collisions with Andromeda, right? That any local kind of self-perpetuating intelligence wouldn't survive. But I wouldn't say it'd be a cosmic intelligence per se, right? It would have certain local conditions based on its evolution. Anyway, I'm purely speculating here.
Well, speaking of multiple divine minds, Matt Segal, who I think is clearly a witch, says that it's possible within a Whiteheadian cosmology for different gods to consolidate and hold sway over different cosmological epochs. This was in his last book. Do you think that's sheer occultism, or is there room in the metaphysics for something like that?
You called him a witch. I'm interested to see how he responds to that. No, I love Matt's new book, and Matt's a good friend. I think that's quite interesting. And in principle, yeah, I mean, God in the consequent nature takes on the newness of each cosmic epoch as it arises. But God in the primordial nature is the preconditioned wealth without which no cosmic epochs at all can arise. So there's that dipolar distinction and complexification. So in principle, sure, different dimensions of the divine mind emerge based on different characteristics of each cosmic epoch, but there's still something I would say in God that keeps God finally one. And in fact, Matt and I could talk about this too. Whitehead does argue for a single God, right? But you can leverage out multiple developmental strains within the consequent nature. I think that's an intra-Whiteheadian sort of debate. But Matt should definitely read, and I push him to do this, John Leslie's work. Again, Infinite Minds, A Philosophical Cosmology is his book. It's a challenging and very fun book. So as a side, Matt and I are working next year to bring a conference surrounding Ian McGilchrist and metaphysics in the matter with things, his recent recent book, which is fantastic. So keep you and your community posted on that. It's going to be quite an interesting conference, bringing a lot of interesting figures, John Rivaki among them, Michael Levin, and others. So the conversation will definitely continue.
I guess on the subject of cosmological epochs, yeah. Another query that I had was, okay, so we've got possibly anomalous craft in the sky, which may or may not be extraterrestrial, or may or may not be advanced Chinese drones or experimental Pentagon craft. Although, if we take records from before 50 or 100 or 5,000 years ago, they're certainly not Chinese drones and experimental Pentagon craft. And if you take more and more of these accounts seriously, they cease to look like physical extraterrestrials. They sound more and more like elves or devils or some kind of multidimensional quasi-entities.
Yeah.
Do you think it's possible there could be residual entities left over and haunting us from previous cosmological epochs who would have a different relationship to the laws of our current epoch?
Fascinating question. Yeah, super fascinating. The laws would have to be quite different, certainly. If I speak as a Whiteheadian, which I tend to do, not slavishly, but I love Whitehead, whatever haunting they provide is through inheritance from the past. And that's a real sense of haunting, right? So it's not as if they're active entities necessarily per se in our presence haunting us from up ahead, but that the power of the past, the achievements of this previous epoch are inherited by us, right? And perhaps more than we know, they haunt us in certain profound ways. I mean, our own families do this to us in some sense. Our own histories do this to us in some sense. So, but can they be present and among us and be from a previous epoch seems to jump certain boundaries that process metaphysics would allow. But again, process metaphysics doesn't have it all right. I want to be open to extraordinary kinds of experience and or haunting. But who's to say we're not haunted by things already now? I am, right? But it's more local to my history and whatnot. So, yeah, I'm not sure about that.
When I was 21, recently divorced, still believed in books, I started writing a science fiction novel that I was going to call Mortal Coil, about an instinctive tension and predatory relationship between the whole DNA-based biosphere and an alien biosphere that it came in contact with.
Nice.
So, and shout out to Adam Wright and Eric Reynolds last year for getting me into 16 Liu's Chinese sci-fi trilogy that explored the Dark Forest. There's a similarity there. And if people don't know, the Dark Forest involves ideas like the reason we don't see signs of alien civilizations everywhere is that any really capable technological civilization has either been wiped out or is surviving by going dark so that the predators don't find us. Mm-hmm. And that whole biospheres are, like the other organisms we see in nature, kind of inherently exploitative and predatory. Now, from your point of view, planetary scale religion, or, you know, is that more likely to justify interspecies, interworld warfare? Or is there something about it that's like a machine that would bring forward the very things that would mitigate and transcend those tendencies?
Yeah, such a beautiful question. I will say, just to point out to a deeper bit of research on precisely this question in light of this Dark Forest hypothesis. So CPS is bringing out a big Lexington volume soon, Astrophilosophy, Exotheology, and Cosmic Religion, Extraterrestrial Life in a Process Universe, where Roland Faber has a nearly 100-page chapter on precisely this question. And he argues for the development of extraterrestrial spiritual life, right? If we're going to get through this great barrier, this bottleneck, which seems to be what we might be running into as a technologically advanced civilization, and potentially destroying ourselves, if we encounter a species that has made it through that bottleneck, how on earth have they done that? How off earth, rather, have they done that? And there's something to be said that if a species has overcome their barbarism, right? We might be very infantile in this regard. We're still working through that, clearly. They've done so through what we'd call, at least on our planet, spiritual means, right? Spiritual evolution, of harmony among society. And so assuming we do encounter or hypothetically encounter highly advanced beings, there could be an argument to be made that they would be highly advanced spiritual beings, and therefore that our interactions with them, at least from their side, are from that perspective. Maybe that's just wishful thinking. But if we're going to survive as a species on this planet for much longer, we're going to have to ascend spiritually, right? Not in a naive sense, but in a true sense of that term. So the dark force hypothesis is I think amazing, and I've quoted it in my book in a paragraph that's incredibly potent. I think it's the answer to the Fermi paradox as to why, you know, we do not see the universe populated with extraterrestrial entities. Many answers to that, but it assumes that our barbaric orientation towards each other, and then projects that onto the universe, and that's what I don't like about it. You know, we still may be just coming alive on this planet in a deep sense. There's a spiritual way of understanding that. So anyway, I wonder what you think about that. It's extraterrestrial spiritual life, right? As the means for transcending barbaric bottlenecks that would otherwise destroy civilizations out there in the universe.
I'm cautious about my own sense of affirming that.
Sure.
Because I like it a lot. And it's very lovely to think that insufficiently spiritual species either don't figure out how to get there or destroy themselves before they do. And so the universe might be populated primarily by spiritually sophisticated entities. And that certainly resonates with the way I personally experience anomalous phenomena and sense of the cosmos.
Okay.
But on the other hand, I want to be, it's not insignificant. No, there's a real grounding in experience that has to be taken seriously. That's actual data.
Sure.
On the other hand, what if it turns out that a fantastical revaluation of my values is needed? That predatory barbarism is actually the more spiritual condition. And what I happen to like is merely the domesticated, civilized recoil from the natural spirituality of predatory organisms in a biosphere, which populate most of the cosmos. So I don't like that, but I feel like I have to stay in touch with that in order to be vigilant.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good response. But again, I think it would depend upon how you're understanding. It's a worldview question, right? Because if that were the case, this would raise a very large question for religions, for spirituality, for God, if barbarism, predator prey relations are, are what the universe is doing rather than transcending those, or those are, that's a distinction. It still gets back metaphysically to what you think's occurring and why and to what end. So if on Whitehead's scheme, we accept the rise of aesthetic value, the birth of goodness, whatever's higher than that, could there be a species that has achieved that and is perpetuating that? I think that's possible. So I actually don't think we live in a dark forest, even though there are dark forests on this planet and potentially other planets. I think the drive is beyond the dark forest, from darkness to light. Now I'm just preaching.
If I look at trends in myself and in culture, I feel like it does over time find its way toward more valuable and more collaboration between values, types of outcomes. I've got a pretty positive sense about it, but I also know that I live a pretty privileged and secure life. I'm not on the front lines. No one in my family has been murdered. And it may be that the world is much more barbaric than we think, and that the way that the biosphere holds itself in balance is by very careful adjudication between predator and prey species, right? Like the wolf has to be starving enough to try to eat the rabbit, and the rabbit has to try to get away, and this sort of maintains the balance. And it might be there's a greater cosmic balance that's maintained in a similar predatory fashion. I don't want to rule that out, but it goes against the direction that I see myself and my favorite people evolving into. It goes against the direction I would hope alien species are also moving.
Yeah. Well, I think it's an important point, because I didn't want to say that there is no place for predator prey, obviously. there is a place for that. And without it, we can't emerge at a biological kind of level. So I think these are these kind of life is robbery, as Whitehead puts it. And that seems to be a fact of this universe we're inhabiting. But it's not the ultimate fact, per se. Right. So I want to push back at that. Dark Forest hypothesis is pointing to this barbaric relationship as a kind of ultimate fact that we cannot escape. And it might be too anthropomorphic. It might be too anthropocentric to say that. There might be modes of relating that we have just not even scratched the surface of. So that to me is a hopeful thought.
It seems to me that higher level solutions only exist where multiple values are able to simultaneously be enacted and stabilize each other, right? That's yep. why, you know, bands of predators, when they have the capacity, start to function together as super bands of predators. But that same directionality moves beyond predation in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
So I have a lot of confidence in that. But I also think, and I'm curious how you relate to this, like the archetypal and historical human notion of quasi-human or superhuman intelligences generally breaks down into a couple of thematic affective zones, right? It seems to be we go, oh, there's some of them are really benevolent, and mm-hmm. some of them are really terrible, and some of them are strangely mischievous, and others seem completely indifferent to us, or something like that.
Yeah,
it seems like the cosmos is a place where there might be room for a lot of different types of outcomes to have emerged.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And with respect to that and your previous comment, I think values and disvalues rise together, right? As you suggested earlier, good and evil, the shadow sides, as Nietzsche said, right? Of each other in some deep sense. So if we could imagine a very highly evolved spiritual species, spirituality in the good sense, you could imagine the deviation from that at a very high level as well, right? And so it's almost like we're moving, right? We're taking a circle from this modern rejection of spiritual beings in some sense, of angels and demons, right? And we're rediscovering that at a higher level, although we'll call it natural in some way. I mean, the whole angelic discussion has actually been a part of this astrobiology and extraterrestrial discussion too, because these have been an example, at least for religions, of other entities that are created. Are they or evolved? Who knows? That's an interesting discussion. But that are not planetary, not biological beings. So I agree. Values and disvalues have to come together. And the good and its opposite is necessarily tangled, just as possibility and actuality are, just as past and present are. It's this coincidentia oppositorum, right? Some deep respect that we're always going to have to fight against. At the level of value, that can be quite a scary thing, because even the most spiritually enlightened beings you might imagine are enemies, quote unquote, with beings who are at a high level but demonic, quote unquote. You know, so I don't know. I mean, this is speculative, but it's worthwhile, you know.
So there's a thing that's been going on in the world in the last couple of years. And when I say the world, I mean America, because other countries have handled this differently all along. But in the United States, there's been a kind of murky semi-disclosure thing going on around UFO, UAP phenomena. And whether that indicates that the government and the industrial complexes associated with them have been lying to us until now, or whether they've started lying to us in a new way, we don't really know. But what do you think it means that the conversation has changed around this in the last few years? What does that signify?
Yeah, well, I think it signifies an expanding openness to these notions. I think that, you know, for many years there's been, you know, the language about the government lying to us, and I'm quite certain the government lies to us. That doesn't have to be a conspiratorial comment, but I think we've seen that in the last couple of years. I don't have to go into that too deeply, but I think it suggests a receptivity that's based in experiential data, not just sort of theory, and based in authority and reputation. So when people see apparently whistleblowers who on all accounts seem to be reputable, it gives them more grounds for believing this to be the case. And even in the literature in the last 20 years, forward-thinking scientists, philosophers, and theologians have been preparing society for this. Stephen Dick is one of them. The impact of discovery on society. And they give historical examples of, you know, for example, H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds is a famous case. I forget the date where this was, his book was being played on the radio, and whole populations took it to be a fact that we were being invaded by invaded by aliens. That gave us sort of insight as to how society might respond. So, but I do think it's fascinating, this content. I think it should be taken seriously. We should do our best to push for trustworthy sort of evidence. And I want to take it seriously, but I don't want to be duped. And I think most people think that too. I think it's entirely possible that we've encountered or already encountered other kinds of beings. The definitive proof is not out there yet. I think people want that. Earlier, you suggested sort of a spiritualization of this kind of phenomenon. And I think of the work of John Mack, who was the former Harvard psychiatrist who spent his career interviewing people who had encountered these beings, abduction phenomena, and not just that. And he sort of gave it a spiritualized kind of rendering. I think we can do that, but we also want the objective side of that. Not that they're in conflict, but we want to see it with our own eyes. And so we see all these videos emerging, right? But it doesn't help that you can make up videos completely from scratch that look very real. That's a very big problem. So, in short, I think it's interesting. I think the government would have reason to hide this kind of information. But that reason, I think, given the rising of our consciousness with respect to it, is weakening. And if it is the case that we are hiding this stuff, I think it needs to come to light. And the impact, though, again, that's being written on, and I'm not sure what that would be, but it would confirm longstanding intuitions that we've had and skepticisms about the powers that be. So, and just to say one more thing, I have, you know, I've known people who I talked to the Cobb Institute on a presentation about this content that would later be published in Metaphysics of Exolife. You know, and people came on after asking questions saying they've encountered these beings, they've had these experiences. And either I say, well, you're just a crackpot, which they clearly not, or that there's something to this in some sense. You know, even close friends who've had a kind of experience in their youth, which they insist even now was absolutely real. What do I do with that? And it was a benevolent experience too. It wasn't one of fear, right? So maybe this pushes us back to thinking about the spiritual element of it. What do you think? I mean, here we have these whistleblowers. What are we to do with this kind of content in your perspective, with your cowboy hat?
Yeah. I mean, the thing about these whistleblowers and the seemingly large numbers of other professionals involved is that we would believe them on basically any other topic. We rely on them as special witnesses in areas that the survival of our nation depends on. So I
And
don't
that's
see
an
why we
authority
wouldn't
element I'm
believe them
appealing
in
to.
this area. Yeah.
Yeah.
If we're prepared to believe them about the incursion of a foreign jet, why would we not be prepared to believe them about this? But then, to me, the interesting social phenomenon now is the massive increase of weirdness and ambiguity around this, right? So it's not like we've gotten disclosure. We've got, God, I really don't know, and I don't know who to trust. And like you were saying, video evidence, what kind of evidence would be convincing now, especially as semi-automated machines develop the ability to generate any kind of plausible evidence? So we go
Word.
into a phase that seems like it could open us up to a new intensity of consciousness, a new expanse, or it could traumatize and trigger and destabilize us and drive us backwards into some more primitive mode. And then the question is sort of like, what are the basic supports and health conditions and practices we would need in order for this derealization moment, this intense ambiguity, to move us forward as opposed to drive us backwards?
Yeah, no, I lo love the way you put that. I mean, even the Clinton administration assembled astrobiologists, theologians, philosophers to talk about precisely what these impacts might be, right? Steve Dick documents that quite interestingly. So it's been on their radar. Some have wanted to make the case that we're being prepared, right? We're being prepared for the launch of this information. We are at a crisis of truth, though, in culture and society. People don't know who the hell to believe And as you say, the videos don't help if you can just make up videos from scratch, right? So we have to do our best to seek out the best means of information, which largely happen to be podcasts nowadays, as far as I'm concerned, and authorities on these issues. So I like your point about if you're willing to trust them with respect to virtually any other data point, then why not also make this jump with them? Or are you just arbitrarily not wanting to do that because, well, that's woo-woo? And dismissing the UFO phenomenon is something we see quite often as just, oh, it's ridiculous, you know. But it's not ridiculous, you know. Life has emerged on this planet. It could have emerged elsewhere, and it could be at a level to reach us. There's nothing incoherent about that whatsoever. Anyway, so I think we should stay tuned and see what happens and keep pushing towards, if there are elements of hiddenness, we should keep pushing towards that. As for the repercussions at a large scale, I could see things going well and things going quite badly. And the literature seems to document examples of both of those. So we'll see, potentially, huh?
Yeah, we'll see. Yeah, when I think about it, it seems almost inevitable that there's life and probably sophisticated life on the billions of other worlds. I'm agnostic as to whether there's hard craft and bodies on this planet.
Because that's been the recent claim.
No. I have my own personal experiences, but they've all had a strong element of ambiguity or of straddling different ontological frames. Like each of them has been strange. It's had a mood of strangeness and sets of connections that don't seem to be purely subjective, objective, or intersubjective.
Yeah.
And so the phenomenon I'm more familiar with personally is something more mystical or shamanic or multidimensional or whatever that is. And I have no real position about physical aliens one way or the other.
Yeah, that's revealing of you, certainly, right? And that's a certain calm you have with respect to that issue. I think the public is seeking that physical, that objective. Of course, you know, there's many psychedelic episodes where people will encounter interdimensional beings and extraterrestrial life of some form, and that's enough for them, you know. But that could still be dismissed as just purely a subjective interiority of experience. Whereas we want, I guess, what the objective, what the physical gives us in principle is a shared witness, right? So was, like, for example, was Jesus's resurrection a purely subjective event? This is a debate. Or was it an objective kind of things that was witnessed by at least arguably 500 people, right? So this is how the story goes. So those do make a difference, but one does not need the latter, the objective, necessarily to have enough to believe, you know. So I agree with that, but if there is physical evidence, I would want to see it. I think you might say the same.
Exactly. You know, I want to be able to trust our civilization's sense making mechanisms.
Yes.
Right. And I understand there could be, like there is in every other area of the military, danger elements where they might want to suppress information. But in general, we can't come to a smart collective decision about what to do if we don't have the data and don't know how to go at this. So one way or another, it would be nice to have as much data as possible come forward and have as many smart minds have a look at that and decide what to do, rather than trusting that a small cabal of dubiously appointed people knows how to figure this out.
I couldn't agree more with that. Absolutely. So, I mean, all this gets back to the sort of timeliness of this topic, not just my book, which is mainly going to be read by philosophically, theologically oriented academics and or lay folks. But I do think it is an expanding conversation. We're just beginning to see, I think, a lot of the literature that's going to come out. And there's been a lot of great literature with Thomistic foundations, with, you know, other kinds of foundations, classical foundations. So I think it's important to inject the important Whiteheadian metaphysical scheme into this discussion. I hope it pays dividends in the future and stimulates others to do a similar kind of work with Whitehead and beyond.
So you write a couple of books, all religious and scientific people read them. They realize en masse what kind of process, theological metaphysics we need to have an effective religion that's consonant with natural science and applies across multiple species. What do you do then? Retire, take up woodworking? What would be next for Andrew Davis?
Yeah, assuming that happened, which will hardly be the case. I mean, I'm fortunate, I'll say, to be doing what I love to do, you know. I imagine different trajectories of life playing out that could have been fulfilling equally in some sense. That would involve traveling and seeing the world. I've had quite a bit of that already, but I just don't see a path for me where I wouldn't be engaged in this material. So it's not as if we all come to recognize white-hitting metaphysics, then my job stops. And it's not my job to insist that everyone must. These are, think of it as a proposition. These are lures for feeling, as Whitehead says. And there is enough content in this universe and this planet to keep me occupied, even if that were the case. So I do plan to continue writing. I write with Whitehead because I love Whitehead, but I am continually reading various different authors, and it's the purpose of the philosopher and theologian to try to integrate and build upon and do something novel. So I think with respect to philosophy and theology, for me, it's not simply a matter of trying to find out what is true and then stating it. It's trying to find out and weave your way to truth in the most creative possible way that is consistent with your experience and the experience that our various disciplines reveal to us. So I can't imagine a path where that didn't happen. So I'm going to continue doing that. And there's a lot of cool stuff on the way. So I hope we'll have a chance to talk again and have your audience enjoy some of the forthcoming material. Whitehead, Tehard, Gilchrist, other EXO stuff, and a bunch more. And I do hope to make it this next year, if you'll allow, to this retreat, which I've now passed up for 2 years for various different reasons. But I do look forward to actually getting to hang with you in person and doing this around a campfire, which Zoom doesn't really allow. There's an intimacy of fire extending back to our primordial origins that I think, you know, we should keep a flame.
Yeah, let's do it. The elementals continue to be key players in all this.
Absolutely.